So you are forewarned, this is not a technology talk. Here stands somebody who does email, that's it. If you want to talk technology, you have to talk to my colleague here, Mr. Kraft. But I would like to talk a little bit this morning about that incredible intellectual tradition that you are all part of, and the collaboration that is so much part of that, and how incredibly important and longstanding all of this is. There's a wonderful statement of Aristotle's that all men by nature desire to know. He was limited in his own time, and he truly meant men and no one else. But we can take this statement in a more general way. All men by nature desire to know. Most of my life, like probably the lives of most of you, has been spent in the university tradition. This brief period when I was working for Jones Intercable in Denver, when I was running this distance learning organization, was a little taste of what it's like to be outside of the university tradition and outside of the intellectual tradition that so informs that. It is a very different world, as some of you will know, and I had to get used to the fact that ideas were all of a sudden proprietary. Not that all of us in the university world don't understand intellectual property and all of the complications of that, but in the for-profit world, I sometimes felt that what was in Time magazine last week was regarded as proprietary by those who were running that particular organization. And I remember trying to convince the person I was working for that we should cooperate more with the traditional universities, all of which he deeply disapproved of. And so he flashed by my office one day and I said, "Glenn, here's the thing. You know this old spiritual principle, the more you give away, the more you get back." And he sort of paused for a moment. I thought, I've got him. He's going to believe me. He's going to listen to me. And he sat there for a moment, and then he said, "Nope, don't believe it, can't do it," and left. So we are all very fortunate to be part of this culture of collaboration. And it's a culture of collaboration and engagement and the extension of that collaboration and engagement ever further out into the population and across the world that you are all so much part of, that we are all privileged to be part of it. So let me talk just a little bit today about the power of intellect, the power of the intellectual world, and what we are embodying in all that we are doing. This is a power about which we have often and always felt great ambiguity. Probably the first great toolmaker is Prometheus, and you will remember that Prometheus stole fire from the gods, something that made them very unhappy, and he spent the rest of his existence having his liver picked apart by vultures as a punishment for this act of stealing fire from the gods. So you can see in that one myth how powerful and how dangerous knowledge, in this case represented by fire, really is. And that the gods are displeased with us when we steal that fire from them, that great intellectual and physical tool from them, and can often repay us in kind. This ambiguity goes on in the tradition of Odysseus. Some of you remember back to your 101 humanities course, I hope, in college. And Odysseus in the Odyssey and in the Iliad, he is often called the many-minded man. And in fact, it's very interesting in the history, in the sort of intellectual history that appears in literature, that how we feel about intellect, how we feel about the wily person, whether we think Odysseus is wise or a trickster, is a real reflection of how we feel about intellect and its power. Even in the Greek tradition itself, Odysseus can appear as very different people. In some Greek plays, in some Greek literature, he is a wise man to be trusted and to be honored, the problem solver who gets you out of trouble. In other Greek plays and other parts of the Greek tradition, he is the trickster. He is the con man. He is the man who's going to talk you into something that you don't want to believe in. So again, this power of intellect and how problematic it is for us. Then we come down to a figure like Faust. a long Faust tradition, where you sell your soul in order to know everything. I mean, if you walked out there this afternoon just before lunch and the devil said, sign this paper, you can know everything and you can also have Helen of Troy or whatever else you want, would you sell your soul for this? And as Goethe picks up this tradition, it is again the power of intellect and how many decisions, how dangerous this is to us. So in our whole tradition, this problematic aspect and this recognition of how strong the human mind is and the human tradition is. This comes down to us, though, in ways that make it so interesting. How to spread that power of intellect out, how to make it large. I mean, up until the Renaissance and then even more in the Enlightenment, as all of you know, the ability to think, the ability to have information, the ability to be educated, the opportunity to be educated, was located with just a few people. A startlingly small group of people who had access to the great skills of their mind and seeing those skills develop. And then you come to the Renaissance and it begins to extend a bit more, but only in the Enlightenment does it really grow in this explosive manner. And we, those of us here in the United States, are the main children of that Enlightenment. And what are we inheriting? We are inheriting something like a work, the great encyclopedia, the great French encyclopedia. Probably, if you ever go to the library again, your university has a copy of these gorgeous folio volumes of the encyclopedia. And there, the philosophers of the French Enlightenment, the so-called philosophes, were trying to gather together all knowledge. They were doing a reversal of the, I'm simplifying this enormously, if there are any historians of the intellectual tradition in the audience, but they were trying to complete a reversal of what had been the previous pattern, not to make knowledge secret, not to keep it in the temple, not to make it the province of the few, whether the priests or the intellectuals or anyone else, but to extend knowledge to as many people as possible. And so they were one of the purveyors of this great phenomenon of the encyclopedia. I mean, we see the power of this in our own day. How many times a day do you look at Wikipedia, you know? How many times a day do you look on Google to find things out? Google, I like Google. We might change the name to that. So they created this great book, and they wrote articles for it. And they did, at the beginning of it, a huge map of intellect, so that of all the various disciplinary areas, so that the independent learner, though they would not have used that phrase, the independent learner could look at the encyclopedia and find out what they wanted to find out. It's hard for us to imagine what a huge kind of revolution this was. To go from keep knowledge secret, because it is power. And just as you want the power of the atom only to belong to your country, so you want the power of knowledge just to belong to your particular people, so that no one else can have it. So they are literally smuggling these volumes into France. They're hiding them in carts, and they're, you know, people get arrested for it, and everyone who is in the power structure in France is very unhappy about this. That is the powerful tradition of collaboration and the expansion and dissemination of knowledge that we are all part of, growing exponentially every day. And it's such a counsel against ignorance and therefore against despair. You know, I was at the OER conference in China just a few days ago, and it's a sort of odd feeling. Many of you have probably done this. You're sitting in the middle of this huge country that you know still has a lot of issues, as our teenage children would say, a lot of issues. And yet, here they are trying to pull in all of this information, inviting the world in a way to their country, and you sit there wondering, how will they deal with all of this? How will they cope with all of this? Because once you have stolen fire, there's really no going back. In fact, in the preface to the encyclopedia, D'Alembert, the great mathematician, wrote that we had to be very careful, that we had to understand that the periods of darkness could return. And in fact, he says in an almost despairing note, sometimes the periods of light are very short, and we have to wait for them to come back again. But the way in which knowledge is exploding in our own time, and all the means by which it's exploding, even possibly towards wisdom, that are being put out by people like yourselves, one can hope that the light can be held onto and be made powerful, and that we never regress to the periods of darkness, although there's always that possibility. So we get to us, to the American Enlightenment, and we are the very artifact of the Enlightenment. This is a book you should all have. If you're watching HBO and the John Adams series, this is the correspondence of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. And I mention it because, first of all, this is a delicious read. I'm sorry it's so fat because it's hard to carry on airplanes. But apart from that burden, it's a wonderful book to read. And here you have two of the great founders, the great intellectual founders of our own tradition. They have a very interesting history with each other. As you know, Adams was the second president and Jefferson was the third president. And their presidential election, the election of Thomas Jefferson, the loss of that election by John Adams, was one of the bitterest presidential elections we've ever had. You know, we sometimes live with one of two myths. We live in the best of times, or on the other hand, we live in the worst of times. Neither of these things is ever true. So as we regard today, our politics might be degraded and we're uncivil to each other and everything else. You have not seen anything until you've seen the election between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. And so distressed was it, so unhappy were they both made by what happened in that election. I mean, Adams never got over being a one-term president. And retained a lot of bitterness about this his entire life. In fact, left Washington at midnight in a carriage before Jefferson was inaugurated. He was so angry about this. So as a result of that election, all during Jefferson's two terms as president, they didn't speak to each other. These were two men who had been Jefferson in France and Adams in England, trying to establish the United States. And close colleagues during that period. I know a lot of you are watching that Adams series on HBO and you get some idea of all of this. Doing everything they can to establish, for example, the commerce of the United States. Doing everything they can to borrow money so that the United States will keep going. Talk about sustainability planning. Our sustainability planning in the beginning amounted to France and the Netherlands. And the careful courting of the powers that be in those countries. I mean, Jefferson was doing things like sending out, we were trying to sell this wonderful whale oil that we had a lot of. And so here's Thomas Jefferson, whom one thinks of in these noble terms, and he's sending around candles made out of whale oil and trying to persuade the French that they burn with a brighter flame. He has letters to Adams about this. Imagine Thomas Jefferson, the founder of the University of Virginia, buy this candle, it will light up your parlor more beautifully than any other. So here are the two of them. And they fall out over the election. Their friend Benjamin Rush, very important figure in American history, a physician, an intellectual, a man who did and knew all sorts of things, decides that they should get back together after Jefferson has gone out of office. And he sort of writes to Jefferson and says, who's in Monticello, of course, well, you know, I think John Adams would like to hear from you. And he sort of writes to John Adams and says, well, you know, I think Thomas Jefferson would like to hear from you. And both believing that the other would love to hear from, they get back together and start their correspondence again in 1912, 1913. And that correspondence continues until they both die. You probably know this in one of those melodramatic historical moments. They both die on the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence in 1825. It really is one of those moments. But this correspondence talks so much about, figures forth the intellectual tradition of the Enlightenment and their deep immersion in it. if there is a civil religion in this country, you know, this wonderful phrase of Rousseau's, there is one sort of religion that you all share, a civil religion, not a theological religion. If there is one religion in this country, one civil religion, it surely has been from the beginning, education. The idea, Jefferson, as most of you know, spent the end of his life when he could no longer walk. He rode his horse over to the campus he was establishing of the University of Virginia in order to establish that campus. The whole idea of our society is the extent of education, in particular of public education. It is the value that we all try to share. It is the thing in which we all genuinely and deeply collaborate in. I used to say, I got assigned in the early days of teaching to teach Composition 101. Probably no one in this room knows how much suffering is involved as an instructor in teaching Composition 101. I don't know if there is a comparable class that you have to teach in the technical disciplines, but surely you were in these classes and behaving badly. And I used to say to my students in moments of exasperation, when they were not as entranced, say, by the late Henry James as I was, thank you, sir. Ah, a glass of gin, it helps so much. I used to say to my students, all right, here's the deal. You can stop reading, you can stop writing, you can forget about mathematics, just forget about all of that. Here is the arrangement that we have. You do not have to bear the burdens of education any further. You can all go out and party every night of the week. It is over for you. You are free, you are liberated, and I will be in charge. I'll be the one who tells you what to think. I'll be the one who tells you what to do. I'll be the one that makes all decisions. All you have to do is give up your ability to read, your ability to cipher, and your ability to think. So the significance of this tradition, of the extension of education, and the way in which we all collaborate in this so entirely is really so deeply represented in this correspondence. Adams and Jefferson, Adams, who is, again, if you're watching that HBO series, I mean, it's all John Adams all the time now, and that's wonderful. He has not gotten his due. Adams, in his later years, he was about 7 years older than Jefferson. They both lived to a great old age. They were the last of the founders to live. So they had this period from 1813 to 1826. They never see each other again, although they talk about meeting, but to get from Quincy, Massachusetts to Monticello, Virginia, or vice versa, and they are both older and infirm in many ways. It never happens for them. They are just talking about what is it that we have gone through? What is it that we have seen, and what does it mean, and what will the future bring? They worry about very specific things: our relationship to France, our relationship to England. They are disapproving of some of the younger, newer politicians. They are worried that the tradition that they began will continue. And they are deeply engaged in everything intellectual and political that's going on. Adams is a voluminous reader. What his book bill must have been. I mean, we know that books almost, well, did bankrupt Thomas Jefferson in a way, and that he sold his book collection to the Library of Congress because he needed cash. They're buying and buying and buying books, and they're reading and reading and reading books, and Adams is writing these long letters about everything that he's reading, and they are worried about education. And education is as much a mystery to them as it is to all of us. If you think of it, education is the great activity of the fallen world. I mean, if we were not East of Eden, if we had not fallen from grace, if we were not deeply flawed, we wouldn't need education. It's the thing that we need to do to restore ourselves, to make ourselves whole, to create a just society. And they are deeply concerned about this. One of Jefferson's great unhappinesses was that he was never able really to create in Virginia a public school system. He was able to create the University of Virginia, but he was not successful in creating the school system that led up to the University of Virginia. Adams says in one of these letters that it's so complicated that a man can never understand education well enough that it's in time to educate his own children. So these struggles that we continue to have with education and what it should be and how it can be made successful are struggles that we've had through our whole long history, and now struggles that are extended to a huge population in the world. A noble task, which cannot be done without all of us working together in every way that we can possibly imagine. Descartes says in the Discourse on Method that the single mind is not sufficient to the task, that we have got to work with each other. We have got to combine with each other. We have got to collaborate. We are all so used to a society of collaboration, really, whatever its flaws and faults, and however significant the struggle is. We are all so used to it that we don't think about it. We think of all the impediments, we think of all the difficulties, we think of all the ways in which we have to reinvent this wheel over and over and over again. This is, in fact, the lesson of Oedipus Rex, in case you missed that. At the beginning of Oedipus Rex, if you remember back, I hope, to a humanities course, Oedipus Rex has this huge problem. There's a plague, and he has to find out, he's a good political leader, and so he has to do an analysis and find out what's the plague and what's causing the plague and what does he need to do. So he calls in Tiresias, the great seer who knows everything. And anger develops between them because Tiresias refuses to tell him what it is that he needs to know. So Oedipus gets angrier and angrier and angrier at this stubborn, blind old man who's been around forever and who possesses all knowledge. Tiresias possesses all knowledge. You may remember that he had been both a man and a woman, for example. He's been there forever and he knows everything and he's been everybody. And Oedipus, who is the great political leader, just gets furious at him. And Tiresias says, all right, you want to know the truth? The truth is, you're married to your mother, you murdered your father, and that's the reason for the plague. This is about, you know, 6 pages into the play. And when you're reading it, you think, whoa, what's the rest of the play going to be about? He's already told him the whole story. But Oedipus Rex is this interesting play where you see how hard it is for us simply to see in front of us what is so. Because Oedipus doesn't listen to this. And it takes pages and pages and pages of this play until in his own good time, when he is ready to understand, he does hear what Tiresias has to say. In fact, there's a huge moment where Oedipus is beginning to come to him, what Tiresias is really saying to him, and he asks Tiresias again, who do you say I am? And Tiresias says, I am on the edge of terrible speaking. And Oedipus says, I am on the edge of terrible hearing, and yet I must know. So there is something about us that means there's a rhythm to ourselves individually, to ourselves collectively, to human life itself, that we just have to go through these things. We all have to go through it over and over and over again. So the impediments to collaboration, the organizational problems we all run into, the way in which we do not listen to each other, all those things, apparently we have to go through this over and over and over again. And all of us discover that what our mother told us about take those piano lessons early on was true. And we now deeply regret that we did not listen. So I want to close today just to have us think about, you know, this wonderful intellectual tradition, the power of collaboration, the power about which we are so ambivalent of intellect and its journey towards wisdom, the power of education in our own country and now across the world, and the way in which the struggle to do all these things and do them well, and do them for so many, is part of our lives. So one poem today, there's a wonderful, that speaks to this. There's a wonderful American poet of the 20th century, whom only the privileged few know, Wallace Stevens. He was an insurance company executive, and in his spare time, he was a brilliant poet. And he talks about, in this poem, this poem is called The Poems of Our Climate, and he's describing the way in which we say to ourselves somehow that we want perfection. We are here to be perfect, that our quest is for perfection, that it is that world of total communication and total understanding and knowledge and wisdom and perfection. That is the world we all journey towards. That is our climate. And in this poem, he talks about the fact that that is not our climate. Ours is a completely different one. And you hear in this poem, he is a great portrayer of images, and he's setting up this gorgeous set of images for all of us. Clear water in a brilliant bowl, pink and white carnations. The light in the room more like snowy air reflecting snow. A newly fallen snow at the end of winter when afternoon returns. Pink and white carnations, and here he changes. One desires so much more than that, this image of an absolutely perfect, gorgeous, aesthetically perfect moment. One desires so much more than that. The day itself, now he's back to this day, the day itself is simplified. A bowl of white, cold, a cold porcelain, low and round, with nothing more than the carnations there. So he's gone from the sort of image of perfection down to a reductive image of this. Say even that this complete simplicity stripped one of all one's torments, concealed the evilly compounded vital eye, and made it fresh in a world of white, a world of clear water, brilliant edged. Still, one would want more, one would need more, more than a world of white and snowy sense. There would still remain the never resting mind, so that one would want to escape, come back to what had been so long composed. The imperfect is our paradise. Note that in this bitterness delight, since the imperfect is so hot in us, lies in flawed words and stubborn sounds. So remember that the next time you're in a committee meeting and feeling despair at the possibilities of collaboration, much less sustainability, the imperfect is our paradise. Thank you very much.